Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
You're listening to Nightmare on Film Street. The current time is 6:66. Traffic is clear ahead from here to the afterlife, but it's hell outside. For the next hour, you're on Nightmare Time. So, let's give a grave welcome to our hosts, John and Kim.
Hello again, fiends, and welcome to Nightmare Alley, an offshoot podcast from Nightmare on Film Street. I'm Kim.
I'm John.
And this week, we are talking to co-writer-director Mickey Reese of Climate of the Hunter.
Mickey Reese is an incredibly prolific Oklahoma City-based filmmaker, and his new movie, Climate of the Hunter, is actually in select theaters right now. It's also going to be coming to VOD January 12th if you don't have a theater open near you or one that's actually playing the movie. But we highly encourage you to check this out. This was featured on our Best of 2020 list. It was an honorable mention because it was still technically kind of a festival movie when we were talking about it.
Oh, yeah. Like, I have a high prediction?
Mm-hmm.
There's a high chance. There we go. Found it. That this is going to be on my 2021 list.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. This movie fucking rocks. It's so great. It's set in 1977, and it does everything it possibly can to sell you on that late 70s aesthetic. It's shot in 4x3. It's got the 70s hair you want. It's got 70s food, guys. It's, yeah, they specifically used 70s lenses. We're getting a little off track already, but if you're unaware of Climate of the Hunter, if you've never seen it, if you've never heard of it, it's a small character-driven story about a maybe vampire who shows back up at his old cottage to reminisce with some cool sisters that he knows. And that's kind of about it. Like, it's just a few characters getting together for dinners over a few nights, but, like, things get strange.
It's wonderful.
Maybe Wesley's a vampire. Maybe Alma's losing grip on reality. Maybe the stars are finally aligned and madness is about to ensue. I really enjoyed this movie. It is an absolute blast. You will find no shortage of comparisons to the films of David Lynch, but that's basically because Mickey Reese is very unique in his filmmaking style. We are not incredibly familiar with his work. We're just sort of starting to dip our toe into that filmography. But, from frame one, you can tell this is this person's film. Like, this is, like, nobody else's movie. This is a Mickey Reese movie.
We got a chance to sit down with Mickey Reese to chat about the film and what inspired it and his filmmaking process. We do get a tiny bit spoilery, but this is the type of film that there isn't really necessarily any huge spoilers to divulge. So if you haven't seen the film yet, you are definitely okay to listen to this. But if you want to go into the film completely blind, I would check out the film first and then listen to the interview.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think you could enjoy this conversation without having seen the film yet. It's definitely going to make for a great listen if you've just finished the movie and you want to learn more about it. So without further ado, I want to throw you to our interview with co-writer and director of Climate of the Hunter, Mickey Reese.
That him?
That's him.
I have a dim half remembrance of long, anxious times of waiting and fearing. I'm afraid we are all alone, my dear.
You're not alone.
I really just needed time to reflect. I've been wondering if I can make a home here now.
In the winter, it gets real lonely. It's like a goddamn ghost town.
He's changed. I'm not sure he's even human. I'm terrified of death. But I'm even more terrified of being alone.
I have revealed my true nature. Now you understand who I am.
Turn the door to hell. You have arrived.
Mickey, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today on the podcast. We're really excited to chat with you about Climate of the Hunter.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
And congrats on the theatrical release. COVID
theatrical release.
Right, you know, like this, it's got to be a little bittersweet, but I'm sure you're at least happy about it, right?
I mean, it's a milestone I've always wanted to achieve, but however it comes. So I'm happy however it comes, you know what I mean? I'm just glad it got released.
Yeah, you've been making movies for a while now. How many is this?
I don't know. You know, because I don't know how you count them, you know what I mean?
That means it's a lot when you say, I don't know.
Well, it's because, like, you know, everybody, says, like, this is Mickey Reese's 27th feature. And I'm just like, this is not my 27th feature, because you would have to go back, you know, 27 movies ago, and those movies were terrible. I don't want anybody seeing those movies.
Those don't count.
Yeah, exactly. So those are more like sketch puts, you know?
We could redo this whole thing if you want. Be like, congratulations on your debut film. Like, we'll just reset from here. This is it. Reese 2.0, yeah.
If people are discovering you, though, through Climate of the Hunter, are there, like, the previous films of your, which are your favorites? Which would you recommend people check out first?
All of the stuff on Alamo On Demand right now.
That's so perfect.
Yeah, it's like there's T-Rex, Suede Head, Strike to Your Mistress and Cure His Heart, Mickey Reese's Alien, and Arrows of Outrageous Fortune. And there's also like a little documentary that, you know, kind of like sums it all up, kind of like a primer to for about what you're about to watch kind of deal.
Yeah, actually, I really was hoping that we'd have a chance to see that documentary before talking with you, because it sounds like you've really created your own little film community out in Oklahoma City, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, more like out of necessity. It wasn't ever, you know, the goal, but that's, yeah.
So what's it like to be the ringleader of that circus? I'm sure it's got to be strange, right?
Well, it's not like I'm the only filmmaker in Oklahoma or anything. You know what I mean? There's plenty of others. I'm just, you know, have my own kind of core group that I work with, you know, but it's like a family.
That's awesome.
And that's just the only way I really know how to make movies, you know, like as a family.
Yeah. And you see,
I couldn't imagine like getting hired onto something and then going on to a crew with a bunch of strangers and like ordering them around, you know what I mean?
So how collaborative are your films? Like, do you show up with a finished script and that's it, and that's what you guys shoot, or is it really evolve once you put it in front of other people?
Yeah, for sure. We're working on one right now, and then, you know, just like we start talking about scenes and, you know, ideas come. Whatever idea is the best idea is the one I'll take, you know what I mean? So it's not like a power dynamic where I'm like, no, I don't think so. Like, you know, that's not my idea. If someone has a good idea, you know, it goes in the movie. You see it on the screen.
That's awesome.
Like that's such just great. And like, I think that speaks to like your intuition. But like, how do you weed out good ideas from bad ideas?
Yeah, taste.
I mean, that's a great response.
It just feels right.
It's the only way I know how to describe it, you know? You just take, you know, what you've learned from making all the movies and watching all the movies and then apply it to the set.
Yeah, because I guess it's always a little risk when you get something creative on the day of and you're just like, this is going to be amazing or not at all.
Right.
Is it?
Yeah, exactly. You go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was going to say, like, your movies are like really unique, and I get the impression that you're just shooting from the hip. So, like, is it really weird to sit with a guy like me who's just like, where do these ideas come from? And, like, how do you decide what's good? And you're like, I don't know, man. I just do it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just basically, you know, I didn't go to film school or anything like that. So it was just by way of making a bunch of movies and trial and error. So now it's, you know, like I go, you know, I see whatever we're at on the day. I don't really plan a lot. I mean, we prep like a normal movie, but I don't really like do storyboards or plan, because I want to create on the day, like as far as picking shots and stuff. You know, I'm pretty confident now in like my ability to be able to make something out of nothing, or make something, you know, shitty, make halfway decent, like through tricks, you know what I mean? Like through different, you know, just how you, what the language of the film is based on that scene, you know what I mean? Like, what, for instance, one scene informs another scene, and then it creates its own its own movie. I don't know. Of course, that's the way it works. But yeah, I don't know. It's just intuition now, like you were saying.
Well, that says a lot, too, though, because with Climate of the Hunter, a lot of it is staged through dinner scenes and table scenes. So to keep that interesting and dynamic is a major skill, because you're revisiting the same table setting again and again throughout the movie.
And each one has to be shot completely different than the next one.
Yeah, there's one of my favorites is just watching the wine glasses from cut to cut, and how perfectly characters pick up in one scene, and they just become a periphery character in the next shot, but the wine glass is like perfectly aligned, and like my movie watching brain, I just love it so much. It's so perfect.
Yeah, that's just because those are awesome actors, and they know the exact moment that they lifted it up or whatever, because, you know, they're used to working with one camera.
It's so good. You know. Well, viewers, we watch for that kind of stuff. And when you see a wine glass in the right hand and in the right spot, you're just like, yes.
Me too, when I'm editing.
Yes. Really perfectly. Yeah.
That's so great, because like my assumption is just like, I bet that he shoots this like a really well rehearsed stage play.
I know, like this must be so rehearsed. Yeah. we were anticipating you saying how meticulously laid out that was, because I was like, the wine glass is in the correct spot.
I mean, it's definitely rehearsed, like you said, like kind of heavily rehearsed, like it's a play at that point. I remember going through that second dinner scene, the dinner scene with Percy, Wesley's son. And just, it was, you know, it was a monster, you know, that's like a 10 minute scene or something. And I remember getting there on the day and started rehearsing with them. And that was where I was like, oh shit, this is where I needed storyboards or something. Cause that was really complex. All that stuff was really complex setup. And I was like, oh no, how are we going to do this? I've never like done something, you know, this complex, because it just seemed like, ooh, it's going to call for a lot of different perspectives on that. So yeah, it was a lot, you know, we rehearsed it once everybody got it down for a long time. Then it was like, okay, now let's figure out how to shoot this thing.
Do you think
storyboards would have been really nice there?
Do you think storyboards are something you're going to have to pick up, or that you're going to sort of fold into your process, like as you approach things that you know are a little more complicated? You don't look happy about it.
Yes, unfortunately, yes. We've shot a movie since Climate, and I went to the locations and started shooting cell phone pictures of the angles, and that works really well, and that's a lot easier than drawing. I just suck at drawing, so I would just be more like, how do I, you know, draw this guy over here, but this guy, like, I would just, you know, that's my only hang up about storyboards, really. It's just, I suck at drawing.
Well, and it's like perspective, too, because you're just like, okay, what would the corner of the top of this room look like?
Exactly.
And so, in terms of, like, going out to locations, like, I understand that most of this, the idea for this movie came after seeing the cabin location that you set most of the movie at. What about that location said to you, vampires, 70s?
Oh, nothing in particular.
Okay.
So how did we get there?
Well, I would think it was like, here are the rules. We have this location, we have these actors, and it needs to be horror.
Okay.
And so that's just what came out. You know, I'm looking at Ben Hall, and I'm like, you know, he'd make a good Dracula. I certainly wasn't going to have a bunch of like kids in the woods, like the movie we've seen 100 times.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just, you know, it all just, you know, you get all of the resources together and then, like, you know, create the story out of that. And that's kind of how it worked.
Now, the film's really ambiguous about whether Wesley is actually a vampire. And I that's one of the things that I absolutely love about it. It never quite tips you to one camp or the other. But, like, do you have a personal opinion about whether or not he's a bloodsucker?
No, I think he's just, like, a big dork.
He can be a dork and a vampire.
Yeah, but, you know, I just think he's just, like, this pretentious dork. And he kind of lets his guard down a little bit in that that final scene with he and Elizabeth that the... when they're having the cherry cheese, or not before the cherry cheese pie, because she brings it. I don't remember what meal they're having, but at his place, when he invites her to his place, and he kind of like lets his guard down, where he's like she's like, you don't go to many parties, do you? And he's like, no, I really don't. Like, you know, I feel like he's kind of like letting loose a little bit there, of just like, I'm actually a pretty big dork. I just, you know, use all these big words.
I got one or two stories from Sao Paulo that I like to tell everybody.
Yeah, exactly. exactly. So that's kind of how I see him.
Actually, like, I'm thinking back now, like, when he invites her over to have dinner at his place, do we have one of those overhead presentation shots of the meal?
Yeah.
Okay, shit. I just don't remember what it was.
Every meal.
That is.
Oh, it's honestly my favorite of the whole movie, the food shots. It's so great.
It's such an incredible little detail that's added in. It just blew our minds when we first watched this.
Oh, love it so much. Is there a cookbook coming, or?
No. We talked about it, actually.
Oh, wow.
But those are actual recipes, so it's like we wouldn't be creating anything.
Are they like actual like classic
actual, 70s? Like, cheesy 70s recipes.
Yes, yeah. That's amazing. The Frankfurters in the potato soup.
The Frankfurters in the potato soup is like such American trash.
And the jelly salad.
I remember first time I watched that with somebody, just Climbing the Hunter in general. And as soon as that thing popped up, like, oh, that was weird. That's got to go. And I was like, fuck you.
This has to stay.
Oh, man, we're all about that weird stuff. Like, when Otis finally talks, it's like, yes, what is this?
It's awesome.
So the celestial stuff is also something that I wanted to ask about. Like, was that, like, because they, from what I understand, the food shots were sort of on the day decisions. Like, oh, fuck, we gotta take a photo of this. Were the celestial visuals of the movie in the script as well, or was that something that was just sort of like added after the fact for flourish?
No, it actually was. Right, it was. It was in the script. There really wasn't a lot of improvising. The things that were kind of done on the spot were that the narration with the food, and then her narrating. She starts narrating again, like, you know, Wesley had long forgotten, like, that was, like, that was like that was there on the fly. Jeez, I feel like that's it. That's all I can really remember. There wasn't a lot of like improvising. It's all pretty much right there on the page.
That's awesome. It's such a weird little wrinkle that is like what I am constantly mulling over in my head, like how I feel it plays into the story. And I think it's like one of the biggest things we talked about when we were rewatching it last night.
Yeah, it's great because we first watched it, I think we saw it at Fantastic Fest?
Or Fantasia, maybe?
In 2019, and so we rewatched it last night, and it's great watching it again, knowing kind of where we end up, because you notice that the perspective changes in the second half of the film, like we're more in kind of the psychological interpretations of what we're seeing. So like the sister going to dinner and stuff, and how it starts to get really weird and strange. You realize that the perspective we're in may not be completely honest and entirely grounded. So it's really wonderful how insane some of the visuals and stuff get there.
You know, if it were up to me, I would have just, she wouldn't have been crazy at all. You know, that would just be the movie. You know, like a Buñuel film or something, but, you know, I was like, this might not be, because it's, you know, because we're trying to make like a horror movie, it might not be completely palatable to just go off the rails like that. So, so I'm actually glad. And I think that's, you know, I think audiences have resonated with it more because, you know, it is, because there is a reason for all the craziness.
But even though, like, vampires playing poker, I mean, you don't have to justify that. That's just perfect.
That is such a great little vision, and I love how we transition to it with the bats flying toward Alma, and then she sort of turns, and now we've got like a floodlight on her, and she's where did the idea of like vampires playing poker come from? Because it's such a fun visual, man.
That is just something. Actually, me and my buddy Joe Kappa were talking. I think he had read the script, and I think he literally said, it'd be awesome if she just walked into a room and it's just a bunch of vampires like playing poker. And I was like, you're really on to something there, buddy.
It's in the movie.
Yeah, and then I was kind of like, shut the door. Shut the goddamn door. That was just like those, you know. I was like, I got to get you guys talking. I got to get you guys saying something. And then, yeah, that he's cheating. This son of a bitch is cheating. Like all that stuff. That was just because we were there and I was like, I know what has to happen now.
Yeah, somebody's got to get stabbed.
Yeah. So I don't remember how it was written, but I think it was written as, you know, vampires playing poker, and then one of them says like, shut the door, and then, you know, cut to, you know, whatever the next thing is. But yeah. But then the cheating thing of him stabbing him, that was definitely not written in there. So yeah. So that was something improvised too. So maybe I'll come up with more scenes that were improvised as we go on, but that's truly, that's it, I think.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
That's all right. Like, I love that it sounds like you're always looking for opportunities. Like, obviously you have the location and you have the actors and it has to be a horror movie. So like, so you're able to just sort of like throw everything you got at that. But like, even when you're in the process of making the movie, you're still constantly like looking for ideas and looking to fine tune it and make it better. Do you think that's what's lacking in a lot of like big budget movies? Like they lose that because there's so much money on the line.
Well, you know, it gets harder and harder. See, because you know, I made so many movies with just me and a camera with a microphone on top, and a lot easier to just find things on the fly. You know, to find like to get interested in something else and do it. It's a lot harder when you have a crew, because then you kind of got to talk them all into it. And sometimes it's worth it and sometimes it's not. So I think with those big budget movies, it's probably never worth it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they just got to have it like really, you know, really, really, really good on paper.
So, I mean, with that many movies under your belt, do you have an example of something that you really talked everybody into that just like fucking flopped? Like it was just a bad idea that you had to scrap?
Yeah. I can think of one specifically, like right off the top of my head, but it's in the new movie that we just shot, so I can't really talk about it. But as far as this one, Climate, and that one goes, those are the only like kind of bigger crews I've worked with. And I say big crew, I mean, it's still a small crew, but it's a lot bigger than just me and a sound guy and a camera guy, you know?
That's awesome. I mean, like, you know, again, like this movie really feels unique. It feels like it's your own style of thing. So like, I don't really think you're pulling from anybody in particular, but.
That's
the question.
That's pretty much it. She's like, I don't think you're doing this, but like, tell me where you're doing this, like subtly where I'm not noticing. Like, what movies were you pulling inspiration from, even if it was just for a shot or how to block a scene or something?
That stuff is just ingrained. Like, so I'm ripping off of something, but I don't even know what
it is. I don't know, yeah.
Okay. So you figure it out in post. Like, oh, shit, I took that from this movie.
Yes, exactly. Like, way later on. Like, oh. And then sometimes I'll even hear lines from movies, and I'll be like, oh, that's where I got that line.
Oh.
Daughters of Darkness was a big influence on Climber the Hunter. I mean, we were watching that.
That movie.
And
gorgeous.
I basically kind of like, visually, if it doesn't take place in this world, then it doesn't take place in ours. You know what I mean? Like, kind all of right. Like, these are the rules. Like, this movie, these are the rules. So, you know, kind of like, when I find it's a lot easier than that, or a lot easier to do it like that, where you just kind of pick, like, one influence, and this is going to be the whole movie, as opposed to being like, well, you can just throw the kitchen sink at it. Creating rules makes it, you know, it makes it easier to work with, because you only have so many options at that point. And so you have to get creative with those options.
So like, what were some of the more like bigger rules that you had that like this movie had to follow by, or the story had to abide by?
Oh, well, I mean, it was like, you know, writing the script, we were still trying to make it like Dracula. I mean, there's still like B.J. Beavers is the Van Helsing character, and you have the damsel in distress, and you have and of course the charming vampire. Like, you still are playing by all of those same tropes. So, you know, so that was in there for sure. And then the other stuff was just kind of what we got more interested in as far as what they're talking about.
Yeah, I think one of the tropes you play with that I find most interesting is like the idea of Dracula's brides, because Wesley's wife in this is like, I have so many questions about what happened to her, because it seems like they together entered the vampire world, but
she got bad blood or something. Like, oh,
I also just, yeah. But I love that neither of them knew that that was a thing that could happen. It's just like, there's no fucking handbook. I'm real sorry. And that's the scary part of this.
Yeah, you got some bad blood and now you're, you know, like you are. So I'm going to go ahead and move on now. You know, I got some ladies to tend to.
So my total fan theory with the ladies of Wesley is that the final shot, like at the psychiatric facility, they're all like ex-women of Wesley's. Every single one of them.
Oh, that's awesome. And yes, that is so.
It's yours. You can have it.
Especially the one that's like rocking in and out on that chair. Oh, real she's hard like going at the edge wild. Of the frame.
So that's like basically our whole crew.
Oh, right on.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Just like put them all in. Because we were out in the middle of nowhere. We didn't have extras. So yeah, we just kind of filled it with our crew members. So Caitlin, production designer, she's in there. Tammy, she's our locations manager, she was in there. And then Jack, she's our wardrobe girl, she's the one rocking in the chair. And then Tony, our makeup artist, is in there too. So yeah, that was basically like just the whole crew. Stefan, he's our still photographer. He's the doctor. Like back there, and then you see there's like a janitor guy that kind of walks by with his broom. That's Nick McDonald, our sound guy. So the whole crew like ends up in the movie.
That's fun.
And the score for this too is so great. Like especially even like I'm just thinking about that guitar riff that's playing over top of the end shot and earlier when she's on the swing. But it has such a vibe to it that like really sells the rest of this movie when like real fucking hard. I really and you've worked with this composer before, correct?
Oh yeah. Yeah, he's awesome. He's my boy. we're having a blast on this new movie that we're doing right now. It's called Country Gold. The premise is George Jones invites Garth Brooks out on the town in Nashville the night before he used to be cryogenically frozen in 1994.
just one quick question though. Like, I'm not entirely sure who George Jones is.
You don't know who George Jones is? You don't know who country and western music legend George Jones is?
Unfortunately, I do not. I'm sorry. I know Garth Brooks.
Yeah, we're not big on country, and also we're from Canada.
All right. Well, George Jones is, he's one of the big ones. He's classic. Right. Classic country.
Add him to the Spotify playlist now, I promise.
Don't lie.
I'm going to check it out. I like Hank Williams.
You're fine. You don't need to listen to George Jones. He's not that great. Anyway, oh, but the score wise, man, we've got this kind of like this very minimal, like a kind of acoustic guitar, violin stuff, like the stuff in Nebraska. It's really pretty stuff. And so I'm really excited to unleash that one.
Oh, didn't I also hear that it was going to be in black and white also, like just like Nebraska?
Hell yeah, it's in black and white.
That's great. I can't wait to see that. And
yeah, I'm very excited.
I also happened to read that you were working on a movie about Marshall Applewhite.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, who's Marshall Applewhite?
He was the leader of the Heaven's Gate cult.
Oh! So,
like the super bald guy with all like the Nike tracks.
Okay. He's like super close all the time to the camera, like, my vehicle is attracted to your vehicle. Like that guy.
Yeah, just like he looked like an
alien. So we're gonna have to castrate ourselves. He's amazing. But no, we've got a premise for it, and it's essentially gonna be done like as if we were Heaven's Gate members, like making the movie. So it's all pro.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but also it's just an origin story. So it's like it follows this like this couple in the 70s that are driving cross country to get to Oregon to go to this big Heaven's Gate meeting. Meanwhile, you know, like Godfather 2, like it like switches timeline. So meanwhile, we've got an origin story with Marshall Applewhite, and it ends at, you know, just kind of the first like meeting where everybody was just enthralled. Told you the whole damn movie. I don't even have to make it, but.
What's so great about that too is that you have so much video to pull from because they have so many instructional videos, like even just sitting on YouTube right now that you can check out.
Oh, that's gonna be so good. Are you gonna do the like instructional videos like throughout the film?
No, because that happens later.
Oh, this is an origin okay. story. All right.
Yeah. So all the stuff you know about Marshall Applewhite, Heaven's Gate, like we're not even sure the death. I mean, we're not even sure the suicide. It's literally just like the origin, like it ends on like a big high note. So you're just like, you know, let's look into that cult.
I think they got it down.
They were really onto something there.
That's fun though, because most cult movies, anything relating to cult leaders and stuff, it's always the downfall. It's always the after the fact and like the fallout and the the helter-skelter of it all. You never get the, like, yeah, let's follow this guy. Everything is amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah, because there were definitely tons of people that were like, you know what would be great if I just threw my life away?
Let's tithe.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, that's the stuff I'm more interested in.
That's a real fun idea.
That's how you got there, you know, how you got there in the first place. And also just their ideas, you know, I mean, because essentially the whole thing would just be him and Bonnie Nettles, his like partner. They're like dough and tea.
Yeah.
Them sitting there, you know, talking, you know, looking up at the sky and seeing, you know, just like this, seeing these, this imagery that they know in their minds is true, and that they are, messengers from God, or, you know, from all of the, you know, things they believe that we would just kind of work in. That is a compelling argument. That's the idea. I mean, these are my goals, but you know, we're working on like outlines and stuff right now. But I mean, when we go to write it, that's the goal. I don't know how it's going to turn out, but yeah, the idea is to kind of like a pro Marshall Applewhite movie.
So have you fallen down a big culty rabbit hole getting ready to like write the movie?
Well, you know, I've been following a long time. So, you know, I don't have to really go that far deep. I've already been there and came out. But right now I'm just like, I'm super busy with getting Country Gold, you know, going, because we're shooting that next month. So,
wow.
You know, yeah, it's one thing at a time usually.
I was going to ask. Like,
I just get so excited and get so many projects going. And then I'm like, oh, damn. I forgot, you know, I have to like finish this one first.
Like, oh shit, I forgot I'm supposed to be on set tomorrow. I can't write.
Yeah.
That's cool. I was going to ask if like the COVID pandemic has been like a more productive time for you in terms of writing, but it seems like it hasn't really stopped you all that much.
Well, no, I mean, we shot a movie in January of last year. So I haven't shot anything since COVID, and which is not my usual output. I would normally have already like, you know, had something going. I would have already shot something, I don't know, months ago, but COVID has definitely been sucky and slowing things down. But we don't have big crews and big casts. So, you know, like Climb to the Hunter would have been a great COVID movie, because we were all together in those cabins.
Did you guys actually stay where you were shooting? That's cool.
We had some a couple hotels for some actors coming in and stuff here and there, like that were probably, I don't know, 10 minutes out from there. It's like in the town of Tahlequah from where we were.
Where's Tahlequah?
Oklahoma.
I was going to say, I think the answer is probably Oklahoma.
It would take me a second to point it out on a map. I'd be like, I think it's right here.
So what exactly is that campground, or like I guess you wouldn't necessarily call it a campground. Like, is it like a camp style camp that you'd go to where you rent your own cabin? Because it looks great.
No, I am not allowed to talk about it.
Okay. It's just a secret undisclosed location.
Yes, it's a private little area. What do you call it?
Commune?
Kind of neighborhood. I don't know. Like, it's just, you know, a bunch of people own cabins there. And, you know, one of the stipulations about shooting there is that I can't really, you know, dive into it too much.
That's all right. I guess that makes sense for them. If they don't know how popular the movie's going to be, and if it blows up, they don't want like thousands of people just flooding the place. And
oh, like the original, like Friday the 13th camp is like now like a tourist zone city.
Yeah, I think they'll be fine with this movie, but regardless, I agreed not to talk about it, so.
That's almost more interesting, though. Now there's some mystery. Like, what's in that camp? Do they bury bodies there?
Yeah.
They are, like, you know, now with the Heaven's Gate movie coming out soon, I would think, the chances are somebody's going to draw a line. They're like, oh, the last remaining Heaven's Gate people are there, and they don't want anybody to find out. they're just building little GeoCity websites in the woods.
GeoCities.
Yeah, they still have that website up, by the way.
Yeah, somebody still runs it.
That's amazing. You don't even have to way back machine that?
Nope. No, they still have people that are managing that, which is wild. So, before we let you go, we like to ask everybody that we sit down with what their dream double feature would be at the drive-in. If you could pick any two movies to play at the drive-in, what would you play?
Oh, I don't know. Right now, I'm in a country music movie. mode. So I would pick like Tender Mercies and Coal Miner's Daughter. Why not?
Okay, sure. Yeah. That would work.
Okay, fun follow up. What would you pair with Climb Into the Hunter if that was playing Drive In Double Feature?
Daughters of Darkness.
Cool.
Right on.
That's awesome.
It's the same movie.
Yeah, we recently saw Daughters of the Darkness for the first time. Same with Buffalo 66. Like, watched both of those movies for the first time a few months
ago. You just saw Buffalo 66?
Yeah, man. And, like, I cannot stop thinking about it. Every time I watch that second dinner sequence with Alma's daughter, I'm like, this is just like the fucking Thanksgiving dinner.
It is exactly like that, yes. Oh, yeah. So you were, like, asking about, like, influence and stuff. It's just like, I just, you know, like, okay, we got to shoot this one different than the other one, so let's do it like this. I knew it was from Buffalo 66, but... You know what I mean? That wasn't like, you know, I can't really say that was like a big influence, but it was, because they're all influences. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All the movies. So yeah, that was a perfect example of something that was definitely, you know, stolen from Buffalo 66.
Right
so,
on.
So triple feature then.
That's not a bad idea. I would, I would love to see all three of these movies together now.
What order
you
even?
Throw Buffalo 66 on anything though. And tack it on to any other double feature too. I mean, it's a solid movie.
We just need to get more people to see it. That's all. Mm-hmm. Right on. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, man.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Climb Into the Hunter is currently playing in select theaters. So if you've got a movie theater available, if you've got a movie theater near you open, that is that you feel safe to go to, it
or
might be
drive-in.
Playing. Or
drive-in.
A drive-in. That's true. Up here in Canada, drive-ins are
frozen.
Closed.
Frozen.
Yes, but you know, maybe out on the West Coast, you could probably hit this up at a drive-in. At the very least, it will be available on VOD beginning January 12th, and you can check out Mickey Reese's back catalog at Alamo On Demand.
You can check out more Nightmare on Film Street at nofspodcast.com, our website, Instagram at Nightmare on Film Street, our Discord channel, nofspodcast.com/Discord, wherever you want to find us, we are everywhere.
There's a nightmare. Every platform has a Film Street. I fucked that up real good.
If you love Nightmare on Film Street and you want to support the show, head to nofspodcast.com/fiendclub for our fun membership packs, rewards, live streams, and all that fun jazz. nofspodcast.com/fiendclub.
But until next time, I'm John.
I'm Kim.
Stay creepy.
It appears you made it out alive, but we'll get you next time. Help us to grow the horde. Leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you subscribe. More terror can be found lurking on our website at nofspodcast.com. And while you're at it, check out all of the other spine-tingling shows on the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network. Until next time, stay creepy, fiends.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big.